The history of psychological and therapeutic treatments for Iowa veterans contains some gruesome chapters. This hour, how lobotomies became common practice, destroying many lives. It's a NewsBuzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Also this hour, a comprehensive efficiency review by the Iowa Board of Regents. The ISU Cyclones take on the UConn Huskies tonight in Madison Square Garden. A fab lab soon to open in Iowa City. The University of Iowa turns down a request to film the popular HBO series Girls on campus. And Jen Chapin, the daughter of the late Harry Chapin, performs tonight in Davenport. Buckle up. Your Friday News Buzz starts right after this news from NPR. It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Coming up this hour, a handful of quick conversations we like to have on Friday. We call it News Buzz. We catch up on a number of items in Iowa news that we didn't get to earlier this week in our talk shows. Coming up, we'll talk about the history of psychological and therapeutic treatments for Iowa veterans and some gruesome chapters contained in it with Rick Fredrickson of Iowa Public Radio, how lobotomies became common practice and destroyed many, many lives. We'll also hear about a rash of curious car burglaries in the southeast Iowa town of Mediapolis. The ISU Cyclones, of course, take on UConn, the UConn Huskies tonight, that in Madison Square Garden. We'll talk about that and a few other items we'll throw in there as well. But first, the first of three public hearings was held today at the University of Iowa in advance of a comprehensive efficiency review by the Iowa Board of Regents. The review is expected to generate $15 to $25 million in savings. We talked with Regents President Bruce Rastetter yesterday and asked about why they're looking at efficiency at the universities.
A system-wide review of this type is critical to make sure that we don't have program creep across the three universities, that we aren't having duplication continue to happen, but more importantly, that we take the dollars where they're being where there's dollars potentially being wasted and reinvest them in the universities.
Regents President Bruce Rastetter joining me now to tell us what happened at today's public hearing. Iowa Public Radio's Dean Borg. Hi, Dean.
Hello, Ben.
So how well-attended hearing?
It was. I didn't think so. It was going to be at first. I was there a few minutes early to set up recording equipment, and I personally counted. I wanted to get the – and it was about 100 at that time in the campus building, Phillips Hall Auditorium. But people kept coming at the last minute, and I would say that nearly every seat was full, Ben, and I would guess around 200 people.
What kind of input did people who showed up have – to give this efficiency review?
Well, first of all, what was the makeup of that crowd? I was interested. I did not see many undergraduate students. May have been some graduate students. They tend to be more adult and older. But mostly, and this, Ben, gets to, I think, the theme. I think there was an underlying theme that I saw today, jobs.
These are faculty who showed up.
Yes, yes. Mm-hmm. Faculty and staff people.
So what was the nature of their input?
Well, they were asking questions such as, and these were written questions. This wasn't an oral give and take, written questions submitted on cards. Concern voiced about academic programs such as the fine arts and English was specifically mentioned that don't necessarily show monetary returns. How are they going to be judged? Mm-hmm. And also duplication among the three state universities. How is that going to be addressed? And how will you get to know the universities? This is a question to Deloitte, the consultants. How are you going to get to know the university's cultures and really know things in such a short period of time? Well, one of the Deloitte consultants said that she has, and this was a lady, Virginia Frazier, who is the Deloitte project manager for this project, said, I have 200 interviews here next week.
Mm. I know the involvement of this firm, Deloitte, is controversial. What are people, some people protesting about that?
Well, This is a cost here. It's $2.5 million, nearly $2.5 million, for the first two phases of this study, and the first two phases will be complete by this fall. So you know it's going to be very quick. And then comes the third phase, and Deloitte isn't necessarily going to be awarded the contract for that. I would think they're certainly going to be a competitor. But that is the implementation phase of all that they found and recommended. How is it going to get done?
So $2.5 million to find out how the universities did I quote that wrong?
No. For the first $2.5 million for the first two phases.
For the first two phases to find out how the universities can be leaner in their operation, become
yes.
more efficient. Let's go back to a little bit more of tape we have from President Rastetter, the president of the regions. We asked him about whether input from the public hearings, such as this one, would inform the decisions they would be making as a result of this review. This is what he had to say. Have a listen.
No, I think what it means is that we're going to kick it off in a town hall style way. We're going to describe how the process will work. And then Deloitte will frankly go to work, do the heavy lifting, and working, as I mentioned, on that bottom-up approach of getting all the numbers in each area. And I think, as you are aware, that you know we've clearly said that there is nothing that's off the table. And I think that's important. So it's going to include athletics, academics, administration, and non-core assets that aren't central to the mission in terms of looking at those. So we'll just let the numbers come about, but this is the start of the process. So we wanted to make sure that people were aware of that.
And President Rastetter also saying in the hearing this morning that the financing of the state universities at status quo is unsustainable if public universities are to maintain high quality. And then Larry McKibben, who is actually the Regents Committee person in charge of the efficiency study, he said, "I'm not going to be part of a study that fails." President Rastetter also saying chances are at getting sufficient appropriations are pretty good now in the state legislature for a second consecutive year of tuition freeze for in-state students. But that can't be sustained and our goal is to reduce student debt and also to show legislators that we are being efficient.
Mm-hmm. Dean, you've reported on these things. We have the wealth of your wisdom in reporting on regions matters, state matters for many decades. What do you see as happening next? What typically happens after this kind of review?
Well, back in the 1980s, there was a very controversial review at that time. And in fact, the question was asked this morning, why do we go every 20 years and have one of these reviews? Shouldn't we be having an ongoing review by the universities themselves? And the answer to that was, well, the universities do undertake reviews all the time at becoming efficient. But now we need to take a comprehensive look at the whole university system and see where, and this was a theme too on the part of the respondents this morning, the questions, we would need to see how we can collaborate more among the campuses now. So mm-hmm. I think that you're going to see recommendations that say, how can Iowa State, UNI, and the University of Iowa be more collaborative?
Sort of efficiencies through merging perhaps departments or services?
Well, that's a fear. That's a fear because there comes the job preservation.
Mm-hmm. And finally, Dean, talk a little bit more about the politics of this process, please.
Well, the person that I mentioned, Larry McKibben, is a former state legislator himself, spent more than 20 years in the state legislature. And I asked him, is this really to show the legislature that you're serious about being efficient so that they will be consistently appropriating more money to the universities?
Would I, as a senator, have appreciated that? You bet. I spent 12 years in the Senate, and every single session that I was in the Senate, it was brought up. What are the universities doing to look at their cost of production, their cost of operations? Every single year we brought that up in caucus. People talked about it on the floor. I think this is part of our mission as regents to do our due diligence and to be cost effective. And when the legislature sees that and when the citizens of the state of Iowa see that, we'll all win.
Regent McKibben there. Iowa Public Radio's Dean Borg, thank you for coming in. The next public hearing will be held Tuesday at 10 a.m. at Iowa State University. It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Joining me now, Iowa Public Radio's Rick Fredrickson. This week we heard your spot, your report, as a matter of fact. Rick, hi, first of all.
Hi, Ben.
We heard your report on the history of psychological and therapeutic treatments for Iowa veterans. It was, I have to admit, not an easy listen in many parts of it because of the lives that were changed, lives that were destroyed. Lobotomies, common treatment for World War II veterans who suffered from shell shock. It was called battle fatigue. Nowadays, we know it as post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD. Tell us a little bit more, recap about how this treatment began to be commonplace in Iowa.
Well, it was probably even more common in our civilian population. About 3 years ago, I had done an Iowa archive special on an old documentary that was done in 1952, where the television cameraman entered our mental health institutes. There are four of them in Iowa. They were packed with about 1,500 mental health patients each. And they were desperate to care for these Iowans. The treatments included things like insulin shock coma, electroshock therapy, and lobotomy. There was really not much that they could do for them. So they were desperate to try anything. And about 6 months ago, the Wall Street Journal had done a very thorough investigation on how this treatment was applied within the Veterans Administration. And I had read that with great interest because of the previous stories I had done in Iowa. And they found that about 2,000, more than, if you fill the gaps in their study, they estimate 2,000 and probably hundreds more across the country were given lobotomies from approximately the mid-40s to the mid-50s. Sometimes it worked, Ben. It was so desperate at a time before Thorazine and psycho drugs were developed. Sometimes there were positive results. In fact, families that had servicemen who came home even went to the VA and asked for lobotomies. Now, looking in hindsight, we can see that it probably wasn't a good idea. The Wall Street Journal reporter who did the investigation calls it medical arrogance, like the VA saying, "We know what's good for you." And it essentially turned these veterans into children in many cases. They lost their personality. They were almost an embarrassment in public. They would release these veterans to the families after a lobotomy with a what-to-do list, kind of a checklist on what to do to take your veterans home. And it was such a sad thing to read through this. And this is all on the Wall Street Journal's website. And we have a link on the iowapublicradio.org website on the story that I had done this week. You can just click on the link. And it takes a couple hours to read this really gripping Wall Street Journal investigation.
Rick, I wonder, are there veterans among us who had that treatment done to them, lobotomies?
Well, some of the documents relating to Iowa indicate that, yes, they were done at the Knoxville VA. We don't know how many. We can assume there aren't very many of these veterans alive any longer. I did check with the Iowa Veterans Home in Marshalltown, where about 90 World War II veterans reside. But, of course, they can't give out any medical privacy for privacy reasons, mm-hmm. medical records. We haven't been able to track any down. We don't have access to all of these documents. There's boxes and boxes and thousands of pages that the Wall Street Journal found at the National Archives. One of the other interesting documents was that the Iowa City VA in 1952 was almost begging for permission to start a lobotomy program on its own. Again, desperation is the word that I keep referring to the reasoning behind this. Anything to help these men and a few women and to get them maybe back home. And in a small percentage of cases, some even went back to work. The Wall Street Journal found this 90-year-old veteran in neighboring Wisconsin who's living alone in his apartment. He had multiple rounds of electroshock and is getting along but remains very troubled.
Mm-hmm. Remind us quickly, as gruesome as it is, what is a lobotomy? How is it performed? What does it actually do in the brain?
Well, it is lunchtime, but there were multiple procedures. The original one was to make a cut basically from ear to ear across the top of the head near the forehead, peel back the skin, and with two openings into the skull, used an instrument called a leucotome, a pointed instrument, to sever some of the brain connecting fibers. The idea being that misbehavior was kind of located in the part of the brain where they thought emotion was. And if they could somehow interrupt that flow of thinking, it's kind of like rebooting your computer, perhaps. The brain would find new pathways. A more modern form of lobotomy was pioneered by an American neurologist by the name of Walter Freeman, in which he used an instrument that it's called ice pick surgery. It kind of resembles your household ice pick, in which he would enter the frontal lobe through the eye sockets, because the orbital area of the internal brain there is very thin bone, and you could just kind of tap this instrument into the frontal lobe and then swish it back and forth and then do the other eye. And it became almost an outpatient treatment. And this doctor had done thousands of them across the country. And at one time did a series, like a road tour through Iowa, doing exhibits and lost several patients during his stop at the Cherokee Medical Health
Institute. Lost meaning they died in his treatment.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
What is the current treatment recommended for PTSD?
Well, fortunately, long ago, they ended the lobotomy treatment. So once Thorazine and the other psychomedical drugs came into play, it's really improved. Just therapy, group therapy is one form of treatment. Medicine to cover things like depression or anxiety is another one. Sometimes you use a little bit of both. Also, if you go to the VA, they have a program called mindfulness, which is mm-hmm. a form of meditation. And kind of the most recent wrinkle, it's not brand new, but it is in terms of the Department of Defense is spending $2.5 million on a four-year study into specifically transcendental meditation, which is a very different form of meditation than the kind they're doing now in the VA. And in 2 years, they should have the results of that. In my report, we interviewed and heard from a number of Iowa veterans who are already practicing TM and have found great relief in reducing their stress and lowering or even eliminating medication from their regimen.
Mm-hmm. Very, very important work for our veterans and others who have trauma as part of their work. A VA study I saw, Rick, about 22 veterans take their own lives a day. Thank you very much for telling us about the reporting you did this week, keeping us up to date on that. Iowa Public Radio's Rick Fredrickson. Thank you.
You're welcome.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, there's been a rash of car burglaries in Mediapolis. That's a small town in eastern Iowa with some 1,600 people. Joining me now to tell us about it is Sheriff Mike Johnstone. He's the sheriff of Des Moines County. That's in southeast Iowa. He's based in Burlington. Sheriff Johnstone, good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon, sir. How are you?
Very well. What's been happening in Mediapolis?
Well, it seems like over the weekend we've had quite a bit of activity with car burglaries in our small community up here. Started on a Saturday night where we had 18 of these car burglaries. Two of those cases, we had windows were actually broken, and then we had some purses removed. And then two other cars, which were unlocked, we had two purses removed. And then we had multiple items, such as GPS items, cash, and different things removed from the cars. So on Sunday morning, we were busy taking reports up in that area.
I understand Monday night, a burglar went through 50-plus cars.
They did. On Monday night, we had the same type of thing going on. We had, we believe to be one individual that probably went through at least 50 cars. And this time, which we found a little bit unusual, we can't find anything stolen. We found that the vehicles were gone through just like they were done on the Saturday night, but we can't find anything missing at this time. However, we did note this individual did go car to car, walked up to storage sheds, garages. In fact, we do believe he may have entered in a garage and actually went through a couple of cars and garages. So interesting different set of circumstances, but we still believe the same subject involved.
So some of these cars were unlocked. Of course, that's easy prey. Some of them locked, windows broken, but some of them gone through and nothing stolen?
Right, and actually some of these vehicles did have items in sight, which, you know, would have been easy for them to take. However, they did not, which we do find quite unusual. So we're not real sure what the motive was on Monday night.
What profile do you see emerging here? You've said he a couple of times, but I assume since you don't know who it is, it could be a he or she.
It certainly could. We do believe that it's one individual. We do have a witness that indicated that she had seen an individual about the right time frame as what we believe he was active, or she. But we do believe the individual does disguise themselves, you know, with a ski mask and gloves.
Sheriff, do you get the idea that this person is from outside the area who's come in?
I do believe it's somebody that's pretty familiar with the area. Whether he's a local resident or someone that has lived there in the past, we do not know. However, it is believed that he is very familiar with the community because he does find his way around town very well. He finds his way through backyards, down alleys, and those kind of things. So my guess is that he is either a resident or has been a resident of that community. It does complicate issues when it comes down to the investigation.
So what are you telling the residents in the area there? How are residents reacting? This is startling, especially in a small town where you have a good sense of security, really.
Well, you really do, and we do patrol that area quite extensively. And, of course, someone on foot at night can slip around pretty easy, even though there are patrols in the area. We definitely tell folks that we really need their help. And what this means is that, you know, to be mindful of any activity that is not normal. That would be someone walking through their yard at night or walking down the street they're not familiar with. Small communities are familiar with other folks that live there. Of course, anybody that's walking around cars at night, entering cars. In fact, we actually had a witness to this situation on Monday night, and she didn't call in.
Mm-hmm.
But it's very important that anytime you have an incident like this occurring, that you have community involvement. And we can only be there so long and so much, and the community will be the one that'll help us the most. And that's what we're asking. We also have Crime Stoppers involved, and there is up to $1,000 reward for those that information that leads to the arrest of this individual. And you can report that anonymously through Crime Stoppers. But we believe that with the help of the community, we can get this solved.
Sheriff Mike Johnstone, Sheriff of Des Moines County in Southeast Iowa, based in Burlington, Iowa, talking about a rash of car burglaries in Mediapolis. Thank you, Sheriff Johnstone.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Still to come on River to River, this News Buzz edition on Friday, we'll talk about ISU, Iowa State University, the men's basketball team. They face UConn tonight in the NCAA Sweet 16 at Madison Square Garden. We'll talk with Bryce Miller about that. Also about the unionization. It's ruled that the Northwestern football team may form a union. That's all coming up along with much more. It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Tonight, the Iowa State University Cyclones face the University of Connecticut, the UConn Huskies in New York. As a matter of fact, in Madison Square Gardens, it's the Sweet 16 of the NCAA tournament. Joining me now, Bryce Miller, Des Moines Register columnist. Hi, Bryce.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing fine. You write in today's column, the Iowa State men's basketball program simply is in the best shape of its 106-year history. Tell us why.
Well, I think there are a lot of reasons, and it starts with two words, I guess, Fred Hoiberg. I know when he, and I try to make that point in today's Register leading into the Sweet 16 game, that after four seasons, he has a higher winning percent. I mean, if you think of the best coaching eras at Iowa State in terms of basketball, you think of Tim Floyd, Larry Eustace, Johnny Orr. He has a higher win percentage than all of them. He has he has the most NCAA tournament victories, four already, tied with Tim Floyd. If you go on down the line, just his ability to recruit, replace, rebuild, and now the buzz surrounding Iowa State here in New York City as they get ready to play at Madison Square Garden is about as high as I can ever remember for the program. Mm-hmm. Probably the only one that would contend with it is that 2000 Elite Eight team under Larry Eustace that got beat just short of the Final Four. Other than that, I think the case, just tried to make the case, and looking ahead to next year with some of the players they have coming in, that Iowa State, you know, I think it's easy to make the argument that maybe this program's never been in better shape.
Mm-hmm. Who's the favorite in tonight's game? Give us a look at each of the teams, UConn and the Cyclone team, to see what you pick out as strengths and weaknesses.
Well, I guess if you go literal favorite, Las Vegas says that Iowa State's a little bit of a favorite. They're a higher seed, but when they got that seed to start the tournament, George Niang was on the team. He's broken his foot in a first-round game, and he's not going to be available. But he wasn't available when they beat North Carolina on Sunday to advance to the Sweet 16. So I think some of that shows, you know, UConn has one of the best, very best players in the country, Shabazz Napier. He scored 49 points in over two games in the first two rounds of the tournament. So he's one of those faces of the tournament in terms of his ability, especially offensively. And UConn, this is as close to a home game as they get at Madison Square Garden. They've got, you know, their fan base can get here easily. They had all the, you know, the historic connections to the Big East Conference playing in Madison Square Garden during those tournaments. So for a lot of reasons, all those things factored in, I think they still favoring Iowa State shows the respect that they have with the players they have left. Melvin Edgem, the Big 12 Player of the Year. DeAndre Kane, who was the Big 12 Tournament Champion. He was the MVP of that tournament. You know, Naz Long in terms of outside shooting. You go down the list and Iowa State's, you know, the sum of its parts. It's not one player. It's not Niang, and I think that's possibly the biggest reason they're favored in this game.
Mm-hmm. What will be the sort of tactics you'll be watching for in the first few minutes to see if Iowa State has what it takes to carry it through further in this tournament?
Well, Iowa State is at its best when it's multidimensional, and that means that Melvin Edgem and Dustin Hogue are able to produce in the post, in the block, down by the basket. At the same time, they're able to hit outside shots. We ran a stat in the Register last week, but fairly incredible. Over there, Iowa State's last five games, and all of them were tournament games, three Big 12 tournament games, two NCAA tournament games. They're 24 of 28 from the field and 8 of 9 from three-point range. And Naz Long's 5 of 5 in three-point range over the last 5 minutes of those five games. And, you know, what that says is when games are on the line, when the moments are the biggest, they're hitting shots. They're confident. They're hitting in the clutch. So that's the other thing you look for. Are they able to hit outside shots early to complement that inside game? And it generally means Naz Long, but Monte Morris can take that shot. Anybody basically on that lineup has the green light to take that shot. Edgem moves out and shoots threes. Hogue has shot a few threes. So when they're multidimensional like that, they're as good as anybody in the tournament.
You said this is almost a home team advantage being in Madison Square Garden for University of Connecticut. Will there be? Do we know if there'll be a lot of Cyclone fans in the stands?
I don't know about the stands, but we're seeing, I've seen, to be honest, more Iowa State fans over the last 24 hours than UConn fans. Part of the reason, you know, it's a day drive for those fans, and I think UConn fans will come in today.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really hard to measure, but this by far is the most expensive regional in terms of getting a ticket. They estimated on StubHub earlier in the week that the lowest price ticket for the regional game tonight was around $550, by far the most of the four regions. I think that's a direct bright. I think that's a product of two things. One, UConn they're so close with a fan base, they really expect to pay more money for tickets and take advantage of that. But, and this kind of blows you away, Madison Square Garden, when you consider it the mecca of basketball and its deep connections to the sport, this is the first time they'll play an NCAA tournament game there since 1961. And so there's a piece of history that's kind of a part of that equation, too, I think.
Bryce Miller, before we have to go, I want to spend a couple of minutes having you tell us a little bit about the development in football, college football, and unions. A regional director of the National Football Labor Relations Board ruled that Northwestern University athletes are employees of the school and are allowed to form a union. The Associated Press, when this news came out this week, calls the decision stunning because it has the potential to completely upend the way college athletics function. Do you agree?
Well, you know, the thing that most people are trying to process right now is the reality versus the possibility. And, you know, the possibility is it could completely reshape college athletics, no doubt about it. If athletes were given protections that unions traditionally provide in terms of treating them more like employees of the university than the student athlete label that the NCAA uses now, you're talking about pay, benefits, potentially you're talking about these things, pay, benefits, long-term care, you know, if they sustained injuries while they played at the university decades later, you know, the financial model could be turned entirely on its top. That's the possibility, and yes, that could reshape everything we know about college athletics.
We just want to mention Northwestern plans to appeal this. It's not a done deal.
Right, and that won't be the last set of appeals. If this progressed farther, I think you'll see the NCAA appealing through every law avenue available to them, because the potential to change the model so significantly, there's a lot at stake for the NCAA as an organization. But the reality of this, because of those things, even if this moves forward in some tangible, real-world ways, I think this would be tied up in the court system for years and years. There is no quick resolution to this. The reality is that this thing could be in the court system for a very, very long time.
Okay. Bryce Miller, sports columnist with the Des Moines Register. Thank you for your time. We'll talk again soon, I hope.
Yeah, anytime.
Enjoy the game tonight.
Thanks.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Fab Labs were created by MIT, the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, in 2007. The core belief behind these things called Fab Labs, that technology will soon create a replicator which can make anything you need. So imagine instead of shipping goods all around the world, you simply ship information to a center in your area and have it built on site. Well, Fab Labs are a step in this direction. Joining me to talk about a step here in Iowa, Kirk Chaney, Director of Operations at the Steam Room Fab Lab. Now, that's a nonprofit STEM workshop for the public opening in Iowa City in May. Kirk Chaney, welcome to our program.
Thank you. Good to be here.
So I'd like to describe a little bit more about what a Fab Lab is and what this soon-to-open Steam Room Fab Lab will be like. It's a community center, I see on the website, which makes tools and technology accessible to everyone in the corridor.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about that.
Okay, well, Fab Lab is actually short for Fabrication Laboratory. And as you said, they were started by MIT in around 2007. And they've become a global phenomenon. There's over 200 globally, and they're all connected together in a Fab Lab community. And there are video connections and global projects that go on. And any place that is a Fab Lab is connected with MIT. MIT owns that name. So there are places like Fab Labs that aren't actually Fab Labs, and those are called maker spaces. But I wanted to go with the Fab Lab model because MIT teaches classes you can only learn through a Fab Lab. There are educational opportunities, and it's just an amazing organization.
So Steam Room Fab Lab opens in May in Iowa City. I walk in. What do I see? What can I do? Why would I go there?
You come in and you would first see probably some classrooms, a computer lab, and then there will be a few rooms that are full of tools of pretty much anything you can imagine, any tool that you need to build anything that you want.
Name some tools.
All Fab Labs have kind of a list of tools like a laser cutter, a CNC machine, which is computer numeric controlled. They're They're like computerized routers. They can do amazing things. 3D printing, label making. There's, you know, usually a small sewing center. Pretty much anything that allows you to fabricate something quickly and easily using any available technologies. Mm-hmm. We'll also have different things like we'll have a wood shop, a metal shop, welding. Jewelry shop is going to come in, quilting machine.
Are there typical items you expect will be fashioned there, or is it really across the board almost anything you want?
It can be almost anything you want. There's a lot of applications right now with the 3D printing and the laser cutting, which make things that you couldn't even imagine doing a decade ago completely possible now.
Like
we're doing a kite event with the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library, and we have created this little kite kit that kids can put together their own kite in minutes using these little plastic pieces that I created on a free program called Google SketchUp, and then sent to a 3D printer and just printed them out in less than an hour, and bam, you can put together a kite.
So potentially you go there with your kids or whatever, with your Boy Scout, Girl Scout, mm-hmm. troop, or whatever you want to do. You say, we're all going to make kites. Sit down at the computer, design your kite, and then the 3D printer comes up with the pieces for it, and
yep.
and out you come with a kite.
Yep, print it out, and if it doesn't work, you just redo it right then and print out a new one.
Well, it usually doesn't work for me because the wind is either too strong or not there at all. What are the things people can use and experiment with at the Fab Lab, I understand, Kirk, is it's something called the Oculus Rift. It's mm-hmm. something like, I guess, Star Trek's holodeck, the Oculus Rift, which was purchased by Facebook this week for $2 billion.
Mm-hmm.
It's a virtual reality head-mounted display.
Right.
What do you see in this? So I put it on my head, and then what happens?
You put it on your head, and you're completely immersed in a digital world. It completely covers your field of vision, and there are sensors in the helmet so that as you turn your head, the vision turns with it. And so it feels like you are really there. If you have headphones on, it's got sound going on as well. So you really feel like you are inside that world.
Mm. And to show you how astounding it is, we want to have you listen to producer Sarah Bowden yesterday wearing the Oculus Rift. And this is not made up. She's not acting here. She's got this on, and she's in a simulation of a roller coaster, I think, Kirk. So let's listen to Sarah Bowden as she goes through up and down a virtual roller coaster.
Oh, there's sound. Oh, I feel like gravity is pulling me towards the center because I'm going up a spiral right now. It looks like I'm in a warehouse right now, kind of like a evil villain's lair warehouse. I keep going up. I keep going up. Oh, okay. I'm gonna go down it. Okay, so I'm going through a tunnel and I'm switching.
Sarah Bowden, our producer, they're wearing Oculus Rift, this virtual reality head-mounted display. Well, you can hear in her voice that it is spot on.
Mm-hmm.
This is a weird experience. Will this be our common experience? Will we be sitting around in our living rooms doing this in the future?
There's a lot of potential for it. I think Facebook bought it so that we could have a more interactive way of communicating through the internet. So you would have an avatar, someone else would, and you would be sitting in a room in Italy or on a boat in the ocean or wherever you would like to be and be in that same room with the person even though they're actually
Amazing.
In France.
Give us an idea. We only have 30 seconds or so mm-hmm. left, but your future vision, what do you think will become of this area, not only of the Oculus Rift but also of this Fab Labs?
Mm-hmm.
What do you think will be happening in 10, 20 years?
I think that this is the thing that will bring everyone the ability to create anything that they want. We've all had those million-dollar ideas, and now there's a place where you can go and build them and test them out and sell them. We don't own anything that you create.
Are there any other Fab Labs in Iowa?
No, there are no more Fab Labs.
Okay, not yet. Kirk Cheney, Director of Operations at the Steam Room Fab Lab, nonprofit STEM workshop for the public opening in Iowa City in May. What's the cost?
There's a variable cost as low as $50 per month for a membership.
Okay. How is this all funded? Some pretty fancy stuff in there.
We are getting grants and funding from people, donations of equipment or money. And we once we're open, all of the very low fees will kind of fund us and keep us floating.
How can people contact you, find out more?
The steamroomfablab.org, or we have a Facebook page, Twitter, and you can find us online.
We'll see you in the virtual future reality. Kirk Chaney, thanks for coming into our – actually, I'm touching the computer. Yes, it is really there.
Yes.
I can see your face. Director of Operations at the Steam Room Fab Lab, Kirk Chaney. Thanks.
Thank you.
We're winding up this News Buzz edition of River to River with a couple of lighter items this week. Hannah may be going to the Iowa Writers' Workshop, but girls won't be coming to the University of Iowa campus. Fans of the HBO series starring Lena Dunham may have been shocked by the season 3 finale, in which main character Hannah Horvath, played by show creator Lena Dunham, calls her parents to share the good news.
I got into graduate school.
What?
Holy wow!
I didn't even know you were applying.
Yeah, Iowa Writers' Workshop.
Oh, honey, that is amazing.
It's exciting. I'm doing a little jig here.
I don't know if I'm going to actually go. I don't know if it's really a good time for me to, like...
To what? Change the course of your entire professional life?
Well, honey, it is a big choice.
Yeah, Mom, it's a really big choice. It's not that simple. It's like, this is where I live. You know, I'd have to find new friends. I'd have to find a new place to buy yogurt. Plus, I don't really know if writing is something that can be taught. Although I have to say, you know, the last 4 years of my life have been like a total wash. We can all admit that.
Well, I'm glad you're being honest with yourself.
Wait, hold the phone. Are you kidding me? When opportunities like this arise, you figure it out. You say yes, and you figure it out. That's how this works.
Your mother is right. Big chances are never small stakes, honey.
Oh, my God.
You guys sound like you're really proud of me.
Just go ahead.
Just go ahead.
We'll figure it out.
We'll figure it out.
Woo!
But University of Iowa Vice President of Strategic Communications Joe Brennan yesterday announced he had turned down a request to film Girls on Campus after reviewing the script. Brennan says he feared the storyline would tarnish the university's reputation. Economic development and film professionals expressed disappointment in the decision. No comment yet from Hannah.
And as I hung up the phone, it occurred to me he'd grown up just like me. My boy was just like me. And the cats in the cradle and the silver spoon, little boy blue and the man on the moon. When you're coming home, son, I don't know when, but we'll get together then, Dad. We're gonna have a good time there.
The legendary singer-songwriter Harry Chapin, performing his 1974 number one hit, Cats in the Cradle. It's a song he said was about his son, Josh. Harry Chapin died in 1981 in a car accident. Tonight in Davenport, Harry Chapin's daughter, Jen Chapin, will perform at the Redstone Room at the River Music Experience in downtown Davenport. And I would love to see you there. It will be part of Iowa Public Radio Studio One's Java Blend series, which I also host and is heard Saturdays at 2 and as downloadable podcasts through iowapublicradio.org. Before we end the hour with a song from Jen Chapin's latest album, let's listen back to a part of a conversation I had with her when she performed on Java Blend back in 2011 at the Java House in Iowa City. At that time, it had been exactly 30 years since her father's death. I began by asking her what influence Harry Chapin had on her musically.
I feel like most of all he's influenced me as a performer of just not really having time or interest in artifice, just in being intimate and honest and just laying it out there.
So he would have liked a Midwest venue like this coffee house.
Yeah, yeah, and absolutely. I mean, and a lot of people, when we're on tour, I hear from his fans, you know, almost every night somebody comes up and tells me a story. And a lot of times the stories involve, you know, he played for, there were 5,000 of us, and it felt like a living room, you know. So right. I think that approach, I don't I think it's almost genetic or something.
Aside from music, in what ways are your personalities? Can you look back and you were a young girl when he died?
Mm-hmm.
In what ways do you see that your personalities are similar or dissimilar?
Chatty, as you mentioned.
Yeah.
I am much more attached to sleeping than he was. He was, you know, and not that I sleep that much, but I kind of to sing. I sort of have to. If you
he
listen
was racing
to some
from
of his,
gig to gig.
He was absolutely,
right.
And he was manic. I don't know if he was officially diagnosed as such, but he wanted to get a lot of things done. He lived. He died younger than I am now. Managed, and he really got a lot of things done. But his activism, I think, is influences more than his music.
Part of a conversation I had with Jen Chapin in 2011 on Iowa Public Radio's Java Blend. Let's go out with some music from Jen Chapin, her latest album, a song that I think may show some of the influence of her father, Harry Chapin. This is Insatiable, written and performed by Jen Chapin.
He didn't really know her. He loved her just the same. Star trapped in her Latin words, in the glitter of her name.
River to River is produced by Sarah Bowden, Ben Stanton, and Emily Woodbury. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.
She is insatiable. She is insatiable. She is insatiable. She is insatiable. She had been a trusting girl.